Right now it is time for David Terechuk and the Media Beat. David joins us every Friday right around this time. David is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He has a terrific website, themediabeat.us, and we are fortunate enough to have David join us on a Friday morning and take a look at the Media Beat in general. Good morning, David, and Happy New Year.
Well, happy to be with you, reporting in for the last time this year of 2021 from the media capital of the world, New York City, and joining the ever-alert Marshall. We often feature a bugle fanfare to celebrate some examples of excellence in the media, but this week, let's have what could be seen as or heard as the opposite of a fanfare, shall we?
Yes. Should be coming up any second.
That's great. Because it's the end of the year, we're celebrating, if that's the word, something like the opposite of excellence. It's our continuing annual tradition of picking out some of the most embarrassing, sometimes funny, instances of media outlets having to correct themselves. Our annual corrections and apologies special has, you know, it's long been an excuse for us both to have some fun, but the whole upsurge in fake news, I mean genuine fake news, I mean intentional fake news, the whole disinformation industry, I suppose, almost, has come up. That's rather taken the fun out of spotting mistakes and correcting them, but I'm going to try and reinstate our traditional lighter approach this year. Let's start with a correction in April this year from a news network that's always prided itself on its fact-checking. CNN, the original pioneer of 24-hour news on TV. Let me quote it word for word. Correction. We got the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears wrong. It was Goldilocks who found Baby Bear's bed to be just right. I don't know how you can attribute that judgment to anybody else except Goldilocks, but they must have done so. And it's nice to see that they even want to correct something as minor as that. And from the New York Times, how about this in June, when this announcement appeared, which was actually citing an entire article as a mistake. So this is what the headline said. This article was published in error. And underneath is a bit of an explanation. It says, a mock article intended for a testing system was inadvertently published on this page earlier. So what was the offending mock article that got published? Well, we had to dig a bit to find this, because the Times, of course, had removed the original mistake. But in fact, this is how it read. And by the way, please note the very characteristic grammar of New York Times headlines. Here's how it went. Fields of watermelons found on Mars, police say. And then underneath is the beginning of the story. Authorities claim that fruit aliens are to blame for a glut of outer space melons. That was in the New York Times headline. That was on the New York Times website. Extraordinary. I mean, just obviously a piece of private self-amusement by someone that went public. But in going public, it appeared, by the way, in the Real House and Garden section of the Real Time site. At least that part, the garden part, was appropriate.
Amazing.
We go on. don't stop me. Another great journalistic institution, the great BBC. Great, but far from perfect. Back in January, it felt it had to reconsider a headline that it put on its report of pop music producer Phil Spector dying. That was back in January. Some readers and viewers complained because it described Spector as a talented but flawed producer. The corporation deleted the headline, and they apologized for it. They then went on to replace it with a headline saying that Spector was a, quote, pop producer jailed for murder. I hope the fans, I really hope the fans were satisfied by that. Okay, from one great organ of journalism, the BBC, to the Washington Post. The Post this year described the Harper's described the Harper's Ferry Armory as the historic federal armory that was raided by James Brown. I think we know James Brown, don't we, as the godfather of funk music. But they, of course, meant the abolitionist John Brown. Such an easy mistake, don't you think? Could happen to anyone. And let's turn now to an organ which is not exactly a great organ of worldwide renown, but KTVZ in Central Oregon is just one small part of the great media army of local news stations. I started my career in local TV news, so I have a soft spot for the challenges that these outlets have to face. For a start, I mean, not a lot of staff to devote to fact-checking or even sometimes simple good proofreading, I'm afraid, and then checking for poor transcriptions of the spoken word, because I think that's what's happened here, a bad transcription. KTVC had to publish a correction to an article that referred to a Democratic West Coast congressman. Here's how it went. Correction. A previous version of this story misstated that Representative Ted Lieu grabbed a crowbar before leaving his office. He actually grabbed a Pro-Bar energy bar. That's too often, I suppose, in the days since January 6th Capitol riot. Such lines may not be so innocently amusing as it might have once seemed, but I think there's still just a ring of genuine humor about that, even though it's portraying an elected representative with a crowbar in his hand. Anyway, still on the West Coast, SF Gate, which was the originally it was the website of the San Francisco Chronicle, is now independent of the paper. But it had to correct a story about an animal invasion of a human family's kitchen. Let me directly quote the correction in its full flavor, having been double checked by a highly trained wildlife biologist, I'm sure. Here's how it goes. Editor's note, a previous version of this story stated that the bear is a brown bear. While it is a bear that is brown, it is not a brown bear. It is a black bear that is brown. The story has been updated to reflect this correction. So, yeah, that's my review of other people's mistakes. Let's switch a little bit. I want to move from being pedantic, I guess, which is what we were. Let's just review we'll stop reviewing other people's past mistakes and return to our very current present times. But I still want to be pedantic about it, and I know you know that I like to be pedantic. Many American broadcast journalists, and it's a problem only for broadcast journalists, because this is about the spoken word, are repeatedly mispronouncing the Greek letter that signifies the new COVID variant. It's Omicron with a short O. It's not what TV and radio announcers keep hearing, and reporters too. They keep saying Omicron. That long O sound, O, is represented by an entirely different Greek letter, the probably much more familiar omega, which comes at the end of the Greek alphabet. We'll eventually perhaps get to an omega variant, but for now we're at Omicron, which is just about halfway through the alphabet. You know, if an alphabet is careful enough to have different letters for different O sounds, then I think we owe it to know the right one and to say it correctly. Okay, there's my pedantry done for the day and for the year.
No, it's true, because I've heard, among broadcasters myself, so many different pronunciations of the virus. And it didn't really start with the latest edition, but it really is. You know, one thing the Associated Press always used to do on their wire is at the beginning of each day, And at the in the middle of each day, when they updated stories, they included a pronunciation guide.
Yeah.
A pronunciation guide for broadcasters. And, you know, I used to laugh at that when I was a kid. I was, 19, 20 years old. But it was such a handy tool to have because it made you sound better.
Of course. The whole point about AP and the other wires is that, in a sense, they are the voice of authority. And it's not a problem. We know this for the vast majority of journalists who, have been with us as long as we've had news wires anyway, and possibly longer. The people in print don't need such guidance, and they can just type out whatever they want, and it sits on a page, either a paper page or nowadays a page on a screen. But those of us in radio or TV or on the internet version of video, we have to get the sound right, and it certainly helps to have guidance from someone who's taking the time to double check. I often think of as wire reporters and wire editors as the unsung heroes of journalism. They work in virtual anonymity most of the time, and they provide the backbone of our content. So let's hear it for them too as we end this year. It doesn't go so well with the lighthearted thing. The lighthearted tone I was adopting earlier about people's mistakes. But I do want to just note that someone of enormous moral stature was lost to the world this week, and I want to honor him and express some personal thanks for his help to me over the years. Archbishop Desmond Tutu died at 90 this week. As you know, I covered South Africa's long struggle to overcome white racist oppression, and he was very much a vital part of that fight. My recurring interviews with the Archbishop over the decades, Arch, he said we could call him, was something of a barometer of the country's very troubled progress towards eventual freedom. So, as the headlines are saying this week, Desmond Mpilo Tutu, R.I.P.,
You look at some figures over history, they transcend news, and someone like Desmond Tutu is probably known in as many places as anybody in the world, the name, and what he meant and what he did. And there's very few people that attain that status.
Very distinctive name too, and very short. He once said that he would never be a poet because he had the name Tutu, but he was a very good communicator. A lot of people have been drawing attention this week to his infectious giggle and his capacity for joy. That was certainly there. Because I interviewed him so many times, we had this recurring thing that we called our catch-up interviews, and they were often exercises in him correcting me. So I got to see a sort of querulous side to him too. He could be pretty bad tempered on occasions, but his bad temper was mostly kept from public view. And he certainly, in all the years that Nelson Mandela, who ended up being the first president of a free South Africa, a democratically elected president by a majority of the population as a whole, not the white minority domination that had prevailed before for so many years. And Mandela was in prison for most of those years of struggle, and the country was hard pressed to look to leaders who can speak for the oppressed majority. But Desmond Tutu took on that role and exercised it very convincingly and powerfully. And it's interesting. One of the interviews that I conducted way back in 1996, when Mandela was, of course, still in prison, and I was banned from the country at the time because of my reporting. But I did a very quick snatched interview with the Archbishop. Well, he was only a bishop at the time, just about to become the Archbishop of Cape Town. But Desmond Tutu told me then how important Mandela was, and how important it was to get him released. He lent his voice to that very extraordinary campaign worldwide, which I'm sure you remember, Marshall.
Yes.
Complete with pop songs echoing around the world, saying "Free Nelson Mandela," and Tutu played his full part in that. And of course, when Mandela was released finally in 1990. He went from prison, where he'd been for 27 years. First place he went was Archbishop Tutu's palace, and he stayed there. I say palace, the Archbishop's residence. Tutu would really kick me hard for saying palace. That's not what he lived in. He wouldn't ever want it thought of as a palace. In fact, you know what he did in his Cape Town residence? He insisted when he moved in that he was not a swimmer. In fact, he said, he was quite young at the time, but he said, "I'm too old to swim, but I'm going to open the pool to all the children of Cape Town." And of course, that meant black children as well as white, which was never the case before. And the neighborhood's residents, the white residents, were up in furious arms about that. But he won. He kept the pool open for children of all races, and that was entirely typical of the Desmond Tutu we all knew in public, and his powerful voice against the evils of apartheid.
Let's go from the very high to the very low, and that it means Prince Andrew, and what develops for him now with the results finally of the trial in New York City.
Sure, the trial of Ghislaine Maxwell, daughter of the corrupt press baron Robert Maxwell, of whom we could talk at great length, the man who apparently killed himself, maybe accidentally, but maybe not, by falling off his boat, his yacht, and swindling the pension fund of the newspaper group that he owned. His daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell, found guilty on all counts except one relatively minor one when she was on trial for sex trafficking in connection with her previous consort, Epstein, the child molester. Yes, a grimy kind of case, and there would appear to be ramifications, implications, spillover into the British royal family, which is quite extraordinary. But Prince Andrew, yeah, who has been accused of being amongst the people that Epstein favored, if that's the word, with the possibility of sexual favors from underage girls, it's now come to the fore again, those accusations against Prince Andrew, which he attempted to deal with earlier this year by going on television, giving an open, what he thought was going to be an open-handed interview that cleared the air for him. That's exactly what it did not do. It was a lamentable performance on his part, and in the words of some people in royal circles who have been talking to the press this week in response to that guilty verdict against Maxwell, the word is that, or the words are, that Prince Andrew is absolutely, and I quote directly from these royal sources, royal household sources, a busted flush. So that's what seems to be the air around Prince Andrew at the moment. We'll see if there's anything that will actually happen on the legal front. But certainly in terms of reputation, he's no longer the prominent figure that he was, even though, and again, we only have these anonymous household sources for saying this, Prince Andrew has been, and it is suggested he even remains, the Queen's favorite grandchild. I don't know what to say about that, and I think we'll just move on, shall we?
Yeah, and one final story, Singh, is in March of next year, we will have two full years of dealing with the COVID crisis. People should understand that in the Chinese city, where this all began, more than 13 million people have been ordered to stay once again at home. There's not enough food. This is a crisis that now is an ebb and flow crisis, which is more flowing than ebbing, even though it appears the latest variant is a lot less likely to kill you but make you sick. But this is one of those worldwide crises, and we see a difference in the world now as the world maybe 25, 30 years ago, as each country has its own divisions. And so as a worldwide pandemic, this can't be dealt with like pandemics used to be dealt with in the past.
Right. One thing that tackling a worldwide problem like a disease, which of course has no respect for national borders, is that you need unanimity to effectively counter it, and we don't get that neither within countries nor, it seems, within the community of nations either. The one thing you can say about China is that when they do a lockdown, they do a lockdown. And what they have been able to do at certain times in as you rightly say, 2 years of our experience with this disease, the Chinese have managed to get a tight hold on its previously rampant spread. But now, you know, as you say, there are flows as well as ebbs, and in China too, they're having their difficulties, and it's true of many countries that were previously handling the situation quite well. Certain countries in Europe fall into that category now. Britain, which had my old country, home country of Britain, which previously had a slow, had made a very slow effort to get a hold of, get its hands around the problem to begin with, ended up in recent months looking pretty healthy and good, and now they're looking like something like having to go on to something like a war footing. In fact, that phrase was used by the head of the National Services, the National Health Service in Britain. You have a socialized medicine if you are happy with that label in Britain, the National Health Service, ever since the late 1940s, and its main spokesman on infectious diseases was saying there are Britain's equivalent of Anthony Fauci, in other words, was saying that we have to get, in fact we are now on, he said, a war footing. Hospitals up and down the country now are being added to, they're being supplemented by extra field hospitals erected usually in parking lots by the hospitals or somewhere very nearby, so at least medical staff are easily added to, and we're battening down the hatches once more for a really serious upsurge with this new variant, the properly pronounced Omicron, and that's what we have to look forward to, a kind of sense of the disease being with us for the foreseeable future.
Well, it's been a hell of a year, David. I can't wait to see what we will uncover and find out in the next year ahead.
Who knows, but we'll be reporting on it, won't we?
We certainly will, David. Have a happy new year, and we'll speak to you next year.
Same to you. See you
then. That is David Tarachuk with The Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. Of course, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. That's themediabeat.us. Plan to purchase 3 million.